Hey everyone, welcome back to the TCP. I don't have a whole lot to go over tonight before we get started. Tie Part 2 Overmatch is still hanging out waiting for a review with the publisher. And I know I mentioned telling you about the new project last week, and I probably should, but I just yesterday decided to jumble up the entire plot and basically start from scratch. So I'm not going to tell you about it. Sorry. The good idea fairy, seriously, like hit me over the head Sunday and gave me a much better idea of how to keep that tempo up and keep the plot faster. And I thought it was a little chunky. So I threw it all away and started over with a brand new idea. So, you're just gonna have to wait. Like, I'm gonna have to wait to start rewriting. So I'm not a huge fan of slowing things down, but, you know, they're not called the good idea fairy for nothing. So Muse, good idea fairy, it's all interchangeable. Anyway. So let's start off tonight. Tonight, I'm really psyched to be talking once again to Rod Sadler. Rod Sadler is a retired police officer who spent 30 years in law enforcement before retiring in 2012. He served as a deputy sheriff and investigator covering sexual assault, bank robberies, narcotics, domestic violence, child abuse, and assortment of other offenses. He's trained in traffic enforcement, forensic art, and served as a field training officer. He's also a traffic crash reconstructionist. And after making sergeant in 1999, he served as a patrol supervisor until he retired. He is the true crime author of To Hell I Must Go and A Slayer Awaits, and also Killing Women, which came out in 2021. Killing Women just happened to also be a backstory for True Crime Network's documentaries, I Survived a Serial Killer, and Making a Serial Killer. Tonight, we're going to talk about his new book that comes out August 22nd, Grim Paradise, The Cold Case Search for the Mackinac Island Killer. When widow Frances Lacey was murdered in July of 1960 on Mackinac Island in Michigan, only a few meager clues were found by the police, and the case soon ran out of leads and turned cold. More than 60 years later, the question is still asked, will those meager leads give the ability to finally solve that mystery? That's what we're going to talk about tonight with Rod. He delves into one of Michigan's most perplexing murder cases and offers an in-depth and suspenseful account of the long-standing mystery, and also poses the question, could today's DNA technology lead to the identity of the Mackinac Island murderer, as it did just very recently with the Golden State Killer. So, Rod, thank you for coming back and joining me.
Oh, thank you so much. I got to tell you, I am so excited. 1 week from today, my book launches, my fourth book. And I think that it is the best of the four that I've written. And I hope that there's some insight from some people that read this that may offer some additional clues that could lead to the identity of the killer. I do have to do a quick correction here in Michigan. And this is it's really strange, but you were pronouncing it Mackinac Island, and it's actually pronounced Mackinaw.
Oh, I knew that.
And oh, that's all right. And well, here's the deal. You know, I had to provide a pronunciation sheet for my publisher so that when they do the audio version, you know, everything sounds right. And I told her specifically, I said, now understand that there's Mackinac City, which is spelled N-A-W at the end. And there's Mackinac Island, which is spelled N-A-C at the end. So they're both pronounced the same with different spellings. It's very strange. But that's how it is. So it's actually Mackinac Island, and it is a crown jewel of vacation spots in Michigan. It really is.
Yeah, I've my sister used to live up in northern Michigan, not all the way up in the UP, but I love that state. You get up there on that north end, and the countryside is gorgeous. And Mackinac has always been someplace I wanted to go, simply because it's so kind of isolated, you know, no cars allowed. All the just the setting's perfect for just relaxing. And I love the Great Lakes. I love just hanging out in the Great Lakes. I think it's amazing. I grew up really close to Lake Ontario.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, you're familiar with them then.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah. I grew up being bounced across the waves on that thing. You wouldn't think that it could stir up, but man, those big lakes will stir up some giant waves in a very short period of time.
Yeah, I just had a guy that I work with part time. He does the Port Huron to Mackinac race every year, and they came in second this year out of 77 boats.
Wow.
Yeah, 48 hours on the lake.
And that's sailing, right?
Yeah, sailing, and they sail right to Mackinac Island.
Yep. And I've never got into that, but I started out as a college boat patrol guy at my sheriff's department back home, and watching people work those big catamarans and the sailboats, I could like, there's some things that you can like look at and be like, I'm not going to be good at that. And like learning to sail was one of those things I immediately looked at. I was like, no, nope. that is not for me. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, last time we were here, we were talking about killing women, and you know, one of the big things that we discussed, and I think it's one of those things that kind of the justice system wasn't ready for, but the Don Miller case, I believe we talked about, it's one of the only times a serial killer actually has a chance to come up for parole, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's the only time that I know of.
Yeah. And I was wondering if there was any update to that, because I know it's not till like 2031, but I knew you were following that pretty closely. So I thought at first I'd ask you about that Miller case and see if there's anything brewing on that one.
Oh, sure. That's a great question. And thank you for asking that, because a lot happened last summer. Under the Michigan law, there was some criminal justice reform that was done back in, I think it was 2018, wherein and this is very basic understanding of it on my part, if a inmate in the Michigan Department of Corrections, he receives a numerical score, so to speak, based on his performance while he's in prison, his attitude, things like that, whether he's trying to better himself, things like that. And if that person falls within a certain numerical range, then they are allowed, or they were allowed, well, they still are, a parole hearing every year, whereas it used to be every 5 years. And so Don Miller, the serial killer who took the lives of four women and raped a 14-year-old girl, and tried to kill her and her brother, was getting a parole hearing every year. Oh. And so every year, the two survivors, Randy and Lisa, who are now adults, had to relive that horror from 1978. And it takes its toll on the victim. You know, they would go through the parole hearing, and they would, you know, the parole would be denied, and they felt like, oh, we get a break for 6 months, and now we got to start preparing again for the next parole hearing. And so the Eaton County prosecuting attorney, Doug Lloyd, he worked very closely with one of our state representatives, and they were able to amend that law through the legislature, which allowed the legislature to consider the totality of the circumstances. In other words, what Don Miller did, the fact that he murdered four women and raped a 14-year-old girl. And so with that amendment being passed, so to speak, that allowed Don Miller to go back to every 5 years for a parole hearing instead of every year. And so, to make a long story short, Don Miller will be eligible for parole again in 2027. And then he will be, if he's denied parole in 2027, he will be still released in 2031. He'll have served all of his time.
Yeah. And for those of you who didn't listen to the first episode Rod was on, we were talking about killing women, which covers Don Miller case, in East Lansing, Michigan. And if I remember correctly, and I'll say I cheated and did a little bit of restudying today, but So his thing is, so yeah, he's a serial killer. He killed four people. But the plea deal, if I'm covering this right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he got a plea deal because he assisted in recovering some of his victims, you know, to give closure to the family, find, you know, be able to lay those people to rest. So he was able to go up for manslaughter with the concurrent, with two concurrent 15-year sentences for rape. So he had 30 on top, and then those two 15-year sentences, he was able to serve it all in that 30 years. So regardless, I mean, regardless of what happens, this is a serial killer who via it's just the machinations of how prosecution works. You got to get the best deal you think you can get. And they happen to give this guy manslaughter, and he's managed to outlive a sentence. Well, so far anyway, but
And the important thing to remember is people go, well, gosh, he murdered these people. How is it that he's going to get out? He had served, just to recap very briefly, he had served his time for those manslaughter cases and the rape cases by the end of the last century. And in 1999, he was prosecuted for possessing a dangerous weapon inside the prison. And that is the only reason that he's still in prison, is for possessing that dangerous weapon. So in 2031, welcome to America.
Yeah. And I mean, you started out, you know, rightly, as we always should be looking, as, you know, victims first. But, you know, it's great that they don't have to, you know, rip the Band-Aid off every year to have to go keep this guy in jail, and they get that 5-year reprieve. But I mean, you know, the things that they suffered under, the guy who did that to them is going to be walking the same streets in, you know, matter of 8 years. It's kind of unfathomable, but I wouldn't call it a loophole, but that's just one of those, I think, one in a million situations that the justice system just wasn't ready for, or just didn't see coming.
Yeah, absolutely. I would totally agree with that.
Yeah. That's a wild one. But yeah, I wanted to start with that, 'cause that's a very interesting judicial situation that I think bears watching. Going on to, Grim Paradise, man, I could just feel the investigator's frustration, like just right from the start of that book. Just I don't know if you want to lay out the setting of Mackinac Island, but it seems like the logistics of trying to attack that case and the isolation just stacked everything against those guys working in 1960 right from the start.
Yeah, just think about that. Let's say, well, it was at the height of the Chicago to Mackinac race. The previous year, one ferry had taken 12,000 customers over to the island for that weekend. That was just one ferry. So you can imagine the amount of people that ended up being over there over the course of that weekend. And the problem with that case originally was that her body wasn't found for 4 days. And if the killer is somebody that is a transient person who is either a visitor to the island or a worker on the island, they had every opportunity to flee that island long before the body was ever discovered. But there are certain clues that the public doesn't know about that I put in the book. And I can give you kind of a general briefing about how this all went down, and then we can get into some more details if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm always afraid of oversharing. That's one of the dangers. Okay. It's like, you know, you have to play that balance of, you know, I'm definitely, anytime somebody sends me a book and is going to come talk to me about it, I'm reading the book, right? Same time, the conversation gets so into the conversation, I'm like, I have to catch them being like, I might not want that. Let's not give away the store. Right. It's much better when you lay it out and you're comfortable with what you're going to let go and what you're not.
Okay, sure. Well, to start, this was in 1960, and I'm going to go ahead and give away my age here. This was 4 months before I was born. And there was a widow in Dearborn who had lost her husband about 3 years before that. And she and her daughter and son-in-law and his sister all went to Mackinac Island for the weekend of the Chicago to Mackinac race, the big yacht race that has become internationally known. And while they were up there, the victim's name was Francis Lacey, and Francis's son-in-law had a mother who had already rented a cabin on the island for everyone. But Francis was a little, she didn't want to put everybody out. And so she told her daughter that she would simply rent a hotel room for the night. And she would walk out to an area called British Landing on the west side of the island the following morning. And while her daughter wasn't too comfortable with that, Mrs. Lacey insisted on it. The next morning, she never showed up. This was on a Sunday morning because she was going to walk to British Landing, and they would have all head back to Dearborn at the end of the day. So on Sunday, she didn't report to British Landing, and her daughter called the state police. They had a small post on the island. And he took a missing persons report, and he began to check the island himself with a couple other volunteers, thinking that maybe she got lost or maybe she was injured. They didn't really know. They'd had missing people before, but typically they were quickly found. By 11 o'clock that night, 12 hours after she was supposed to show up at British Landing, he finally called his post commander, who was over in St. Ignace on the mainland, and told him what was going on, and the investigation really began from there. There was a point on I don't want to give away too much of the story, but her body was recovered 4 days after she was reported missing. It was along the west side of the island, about halfway between the village of Mackinac Island and the British Landing along the west side of the island. It was about 3.5 miles from town. And she had been raped. She'd been assaulted, and she'd been strangled with her own panties. And there was some significant decomposition that had started because it was so hot out there. And then there was some rain. At one point, they had to put off the search for her. But they did determine that she was sexually assaulted, and that is where the investigation began. And a lot of that was, a lot of the investigation was, they would get tips. The state police would get tips, and they would check around, well, who quit on the morning that she came up missing, or who quit on the day that, that her body was found. And some of the tips were very, very promising. And they actually had developed some suspects, and they were able to actually clear those suspects through some forensic analysis, some basic forensic analysis that was available back in 1960. I say right in the foreword to the book or the preface to the book that the investigation would be conducted a lot like an investigation would be today by law enforcement, and yet it would also be done a lot differently. And by differently, I mean autopsy protocols are different. DNA is available today that wasn't available 60 years ago, DNA technology. There's just a lot of things that would be available today that weren't available back then, which I think could have made a difference in this case had they been available back then.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that that I really liked about this book was just trying to remember that, you know, I don't have geofencing. I can't send a subpoena and see how many cell phones are bouncing off the cell towers on Mackinac Island on the day she, you know, disappeared. I can't, you know, scan faces at the port, you know, for everybody who's jumping on or off the island in that time frame. And, you know, and we'll get into the DNA thing, but it's interesting. And you lay out the energy that these detectives had, and just check. I mean, it is nothing but shoe leather for these guys. And I was wondering, one of the questions I had in the margin, you know, well, it's also, you know, it's a comment on the way I really like your books, because you lay out your books cop first, and true crime. Sometimes we can get away from that. And I'm really not a fan of the true crime, and I'm not going to say anything, but the true crime that just kind of glorifies the bad guy, I can't really get down with. But the way you lay out the hard work of the way these cops went about with the technology they had at the time, and the way they leveraged their communication, limited communication at the time, they put a ton of energy into this thing. It's not like they, you know, papered it and moved on until something came up. But I wanted to ask you about the task force that they set up. At one point, I think it was relatively early on. So the state police find her. State guys process, but it seemed very early on there were two cops from Detroit that were brought up, and I wondered, as I was reading, was that something that the, you know, the experience level of the guys up in Mackinac Island and up in the UP, not a whole lot of murders up there, but, you know, Detroit, whole different story. So was there, did you find any research, or did I just miss it, where they were just like, hey, this is not something we're used to, let's get a couple of detectives from Detroit to come up? Or was it a voluntary thing, or can you go into that?
That's a good question. I don't know if it was voluntary or not. I know that there were three state troopers assigned to Mackinac Island during the summer. And they would take the ferry over from St. Ignace every day, one trooper. So you had one trooper on duty at a time, probably during the day shift. And then you had the Mackinac Island Police Department, which was probably, you know, three or four guys. And then you had the Park Police, and you had the Mackinac County Sheriff's Office, which is actually in St. Ignace, not on the island. And so that was the law enforcement. When her body was found and it turned into a murder investigation, that contingent of maybe six or seven officers total turned into like 25 detectives and troopers. And they did come from all over the state. I know that they sent the crime team, or the crime lab team, from Lansing to process the crime scene. And so they ended up having to leave her body out in the wilderness, obviously guarded by a couple troopers overnight, until, you know, the crime scene techs could get up there, you know, 5 or 6 hours later. They did bring in detectives from Lansing, from Marquette, from East Tawas, just a variety of places. There was even one down from Centerline down in the Detroit area. And the investigation, because so many people were transient that weekend, the investigation took so many turns. They'd get a tip about somebody that lived in Detroit that was supposedly on the island for that particular weekend. And so they'd have to have detectives at the Redford Post or the Detroit Post or the Lansing Post or all over the state. And then they had to get the Indiana State Police involved, because one of the prime suspects lived in Indiana and had left the island that morning. And so there was a real hodgepodge of law enforcement involved from around the country on this particular murder. It was a fascinating case. It really is.
Yeah. The cooperation alone, this is 60 years on, but it just seemed like the cooperation and the amount of documentation that you were able to find and lay out, with all those different entities working together, it was very amazing to me that there wasn't more lost and no, by no fault of anybody or no egos or anything, but just the simple fact of all the different entities chasing down leads and interviewing and interrogating and not losing focus seemed, seem pretty, you know, interesting to me, because it's so easy to do that. You know, how many times have you seen a task force, one part's thinking they're doing right, the other part's thinking they're doing right. They don't compare notes and they miss something completely, right?
Right. And honestly, this went on for probably 2 or 3 weeks, and they realized that they really weren't gaining any traction in the case. And there's only so much they can do. And so they slowly were dispatched back to the posts where they came from. And the task force eventually dwindled back down to, you know, 2 or 3 detectives from St. Ignace working the entire case. But with that being said, as tips came in throughout the years, that case was always at the forefront, because everybody had heard about the unsolved murder on Mackinac Island. Today, I think that's a different story. I think when you say to someone, hey, did you know there was a murder on Mackinac Island? And they go, oh, no, when? Well, it was in 1960 and it was never solved. People are amazed by that. And as the years went on, every time a tip was received, the Michigan State Police diligently investigated that tip. And it panned out across the country, all the way out to the Dakotas, to Minnesota, to Indiana. They looked at so many people in this case. And eventually, I think that it boils down to two people. And sadly, both of them are dead now. But I lay out my case for the one person as a new person of interest in this case, based on his history. And I'll just give you a brief rundown about this guy.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about Weingarten?
Yeah, Weingarten.
Weingarten, yeah, yep.
A guy by the name of Gerald Weingarten. And I'm just going to tell you how I came across his name. Back in 2007, I was contacted by a TV show called Accident Investigator, and they wanted to shoot a couple TV shows about a couple wrecks that I had worked. And so I'm up in Canada, up in Montreal, filming these two TV shows. And I turn on the TV and I see a buddy of mine who's a defense attorney here in the Lansing area. And he's on this true crime show, but it's in French. I can't understand a word of saying because it's dubbed in French. And so I get back and I call him up and I said, hey, Vince, I said, I saw you on this crime show. I didn't know you could speak French. And he kind of laughed and he said, that's an old case I had back in 2001, Gerald Weingarten. And I never gave it a second thought. And so jump ahead a couple years, I'm retired and I've got a consulting business and I work a lot, very closely with a private investigator. And we'd talk about our cases that we get. And so he calls me up one day and he says, yeah, I got this woman called me and she wanted me to look into her brother's case and see if there's anything that the police did wrong. You know, maybe he could get out. And I said, well, what's his name? And he said, Gerald Weingarten. And I said, oh, you don't want to take that case. I said, that guy's a killer. So he said, oh, okay. So forget about Gerald Weingarten again. I'm trying to decide. Jump ahead a couple of years. I'm trying to decide on my next book, and I'm teetering on this Mackinac case. And my buddy Vince calls me, and he says, he leaves me a message, and he says, "Hey, you ought to do a book about Gerald Weingarten." And I thought, why does that name keep coming up in my life? And I thought, hey, maybe that would be a good book. So I started looking into it. And I found out there had already been a book written about it by an author named Anthony Hornus, H-O-R-N-U-S. And it's a great book. It's called An Ordinary Killer. And it's about a murder in Owosso, a small town northeast of Lansing. And Gerald Weingarten is the prime suspect in that. So this book was written about that. But I got to checking and I thought, his first arrest was probably in the 70s. Well, it turns out his first arrest was 1961, wow. Just a year after the Mackinac Island case. And without going into a lot more detail about other things that I found out about Weingart, I think that he is a legitimate person of interest that they should look into. I'm not saying that he did it by any means, but they've had 63 years to solve this case and they haven't done it yet. So I think that he's a viable person of interest to look at in this case. And I'm just going to be very frank with you. You got to read the book to find out why I think that.
Yep. Yeah. And I'm not going to go any further than to say, I think Weingarten is kind of a fascinating, suspect with, it seemed like he started out with organized and with a trajectory, and then it seemed like it all crashed.
I totally agree.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's not to be a jerk, but it's like the penultimate peaked in high school guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm not gonna go any more on that one. But so yeah, you got to read the book. It's a really the way that case is laid out. It's not a heavy lift to what you ask them to do. In the end of the book is not a heavy lift. And that's, like I think we talked about a little bit before, you need a couple of interns and some rubber gloves, and they got a long, busy day ahead of them to get it done. Right. Just to get the job done, do a request to the lab and call it a day. It's a yes or a no.
I'm going to tell you, I haven't given up on this. Well, I am well into my fifth book. Writing that this case, I think that this case is solvable. I really do. And there was another person named in the book, and I'm not going to tell you who it was because I don't want to give away a lot of the book. But there is another person that's mentioned in the book that I think is a very good suspect also. And when someone reads the book, hopefully they'll pick up on it based on some of the forensic evidence that was recovered from Mrs. Lacey's body. But beyond that, I turned over everything that I had developed about Gerald Weingart to the Michigan State Police in the form of a short report. I think it was, 28 pages or something like that. And I spoke with the cold case detective in St. Ignace. And the problem is that it is still considered an open murder investigation. And so they're very reluctant to talk about, what has happened on their end. Even though I used to be in law enforcement, I had a very decorated career in law enforcement. But even with that, they don't discuss open cases. And I get that. I get that. So hopefully they have enough information to go forward. I think that I found out some information from another cold case detective that I know, and we think that the evidence in this case is probably not in St. Ignace, and it's probably not in Lansing's long-term storage. I think that if it does still exist, it's probably up in Marquette. Marquette is the district headquarters for the entire Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And so I think if it's in any type of long-term storage, it's probably up there.
And as that thing, as you wrote it, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but, you wrote it, that case didn't die. It just kept, like you said, leads after leads after leads. And so if it's sitting up there, I mean, if that's a procedure right there to go put that evidence up in storage, very easy for that box to just get jumbled up, with the rest of them. And that's
absolutely
just from experience in the evidence room. It's you'd be afraid, very surprised at what can go missing, but not be lost at the same time. Right.
Correct. You're absolutely right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And one of the issues in this case that I discovered, Michigan State Police has a top-notch, one of the best in the country, crime laboratories. They have crime labs located in different regions around the state. in 1960, it was called the Criminal Detection Laboratory, and it was not affiliated with the Michigan State Police a part of the Michigan State Police. They were affiliated in the fact that they were a forensic laboratory, but they were actually part of the Michigan Department of Public Health. And so their office was on the north end of Lansing, Michigan, while Michigan State Police headquarters was in East Lansing, Michigan. So part of the evidence, I'm certain, went to the East Lansing headquarters, while the forensic evidence was out at the crime lab. Well, once in the mid-70s, when all of the evidence was transferred to the long-term storage for the state police, there's no record of what happened to the forensic laboratory or the evidence that was stored at the forensic crime detection laboratory out at the public health department.
That's a huge
issue. Mm-hmm. Unless I just didn't get those reports. I filed a Freedom of Information request with the Michigan State Police. This is a great story. And they called me up after I filed it. And I thought, well, that's very professional of them. And she says, yeah, we got your FOIA request. And we've got the report. We just, in good faith, we'd like half the money up front. And I said, okay, well, what is it? $200-$300? Sure, no problem. She goes, it's looking more like about $2,500. Yeah. Inflation. And after I caught my breath, got my breath back, I said, can I call you back? So I did the next day, and I ended up paying an ungodly amount of money for the entire 2,000 pages of report. Now, hopefully they sent it all. If they've got some lab reports there that I don't know about, I guess I'll never know. But
yeah, time can even get the bureaucracy. But yeah, it's got to be frustrating. That ledger's there someplace. It just got misfiled, or the people breaking down that crime lab just ran out of time, or they got hungry, had to go to lunch, and they just set it down and gotten lost in time, but still sitting someplace under government control, right?
Yeah, and I hope we're all wrong on that. It's interesting. I talked to I'm not going to tell you who they are. I don't even mention them in the book, but I've talked to some locals, people associated with Mackinac Island, and you get a varying degree of opinions on how this murder took place. And some of the island people think that it was somebody from the outside. Some of them think that it was somebody that lived on the island. Others think that it was an insurance job. And none of those scenarios really fit. There was one scenario near the end of the book that I outline where I thought, hey, maybe this is the guy, and they just haven't proven it yet. And it's not. I was able to show that it was not him. And so I think that it certainly was an outsider that committed the murder. The question is, was it a serial killer? And I think that I make a very strong case for that in the book.
Yeah, I would agree. And I want, again, afraid of giving too many details to, that balance is always there, but we've been talking about the last couple of minutes, the evidence, and how there's still in the event that evidence can be located, there's still an opportunity to run those tests and compare to various opportunities now with the way DNA is collected and the different databases out there. But whenever we're talking about this, and as I'm reading the book, keeping your mindset into that 1960s no cell phones, no understanding of DNA. They had an understanding of blood typing, but the DNA is not even on the radar. And that these guys, like you said, the crime techs from the state crime lab, the care that they would have had to go through to professionalism to properly package the evidence that they could recover. And then the fact that we have live references today of various cases going back decades that this evidence is properly packaged. They didn't know, they had zero idea that they're holding the golden ticket in their hands as they're properly storing this evidence in a way that it's not going to degrade for decades. And in any given day, you can see a cold case out there where they're able to recover this DNA and then apply it to whatever references they have and crack these cold cases. It's just very interesting to me. The care that they took, again, like the professionalism of the detectives, these crime scene techs were able to, collect things that could still 60 years later, crack the case wide open. It could be literally a dinner bell leading to a subject. I always like doing that. I always like keeping that in my head.
I totally agree. And that's why I say, if that evidence can be located, there's two people that they could either implicate or they could clear. And there's nobody else on the radar right now. Zero that I know of.
Yep. And it's such a long list of leads that those investigators right from the start had to run down. Like you said, the task force issue, the army of cops that they've got flooding this case to begin with. And some of them were just downright, guys standing behind a guy who looks fidgety in a bus station. It's like, okay, yeah, I guess we got to track that guy down. And then the dude who was hiking and just ran into a naked guy in the middle of the woods on Mackinac Island.
If
you're sitting in the bullpen and somebody takes that call and the sergeant's holding up the lead, like, who's chasing the naked guy down? Right. After chasing the rest, after all the other steps you're taking, you're just happen to be the one not typing at your desk, and the sergeant's like, all right, go find this naked guy, figure out what he wanted.
Yeah, exactly. The other fun part about writing this book was a little bit of trivia that, and my friends will all tell you that I'm a trivia nut, it's really the only thing that I can remember. But the interesting part was that the movie, it was called Anatomy of a Murder, and it starred Jimmy Stewart. And it premiered in 1959. It's black and white. It's a classic Jimmy Stewart movie. And it's about a murder in the UP in Thunder Bay on the north side of Lake Superior, where an ex-state trooper, an ex-MSP trooper who owned a bar up there, ended up getting shot and killed by a guy. And the movie is based on that. And one of the detectives that worked on the Lacey homicide, Anthony Sprato, you've probably read his name.
Yep, several I know the names.
Name. He was part of that investigation. And his character is played by an actor named Ken Lynch. Now, they change his name in the movie. So Anthony Sprato is not a character in the movie. It's a different name. But the actor Ken Lynch played Anthony Sprato's part. That's, I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's wild. Well, it's a big geographic area, but as far as like crime and law enforcement goes, I mean, it's Mackinac Island, for those who, I mean, I think we talked about it a little bit, but there are no cars there. Like there's ferry across, that no cars, horses and bikes, right? You lay out the setting really nice, but nice, quaint, isolated place. Where, like you said, murders don't happen. Like you go tell a tourist that there's an unsolved homicide from 60 years there, they would have no idea what you're talking about, right?
Exactly. So and maybe I should have started our discussion with a little description of Mackinac Island. And you're correct. In 1898, they banned the horseless carriage, and it has been that way ever since. You take a ferry to Mackinac Island, or you fly in, and you either ride on a horse, take a horse and carriage, or you ride a bicycle, or you walk. They do have emergency vehicles on the island. They have a fire department, and they have an ambulance. The police department has a vehicle. But those are seldom seen vehicles, and that adds to the ambiance. You know, you have, I pointed out in the book, you have this Victorian charm of Mackinac Island, and yet you have gigantic 1,000-foot freighters passing in the distance on Lake Huron. It's just it's a little strange to see that, but it is just a beautiful, beautiful place. There's a lot of geographic outcroppings, geolithic outcroppings. I'm not sure I'm saying that right. There's the Grand Hotel, a very famous hotel. There's Fort Mackinac on the island. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And it really is considered the crown jewel of vacation destinations in Michigan and from around the country. People travel there from all over the world, actually.
Yeah, even before you sent the book to me, it's on my list. It's been on my list a long time, just because, like I said, it's that setting. I miss that northern setting up on those big lakes. So I gotta get back up there sometime. I love my little southern town, but I gotta go up north again to visit that place at some point. Let's see. Oh man, I just completely lost my train of thought. Oh, I was that led me to think of. You're really diligent about your footnotes throughout this book. Like it's you mentioned the FOIA, the research that you lay out in the newspaper clippings and the histories. Did you go up to Mackinac and find anybody that was around at the time of this, or did you have to go up there and dig through their historical records or anything in addition to the FOIAs and stuff? How'd you piece all this together?
Both, actually. I started with Facebook, believe it or not. There is a gentleman that I mentioned in the book, Dennis Cawthorn, who wrote a book about Mackinac Island. It's called Mackinac Island, Up Close, Personal, and I forget the exact subtitle. But it is all about Mackinac Island and the politics and the people and the history. And so I called Dennis up, and he's a former Michigan State legislator. And he said, listen, he said, any questions you have about about Mackinac Island, he said, read my book first, because that'll probably answer all of them. And it did. And he was very gracious, and he arrived on Mackinac Island literally 6 months before the murder and fell in love with it. And so he has lived on and off the island for the last 60 years. I also went up there. I was able to contact some people through Facebook. A couple of them responded. I sent some letters to some people on the island. They did not respond, and I understand that. So I went up there. I wanted to go to the Murray Hotel is where Frances Lacy stayed and where she was last seen. And so I stayed at the Murray Hotel on the second floor like she did. It's been redone, so the room that she had no longer exists. I don't know which room it was because they didn't have the floor plan from back in the 60s. But I wanted to walk the same route that she did. And so I started off in the morning and walked 3.5 miles. And as I'm walking, I'm thinking, you know, I'm probably not even going to be able to identify this spot because her body was found behind a gate, which had these huge stone pillars on either side of it. And it was right next to the Lakeshore Road. And so as I'm walking along with Lake Huron on my left and these steep cliffs on my right and all these cedar trees, I'm thinking to myself, you're not going to find it. And I rounded this bend, and there it was. It was like the Holy Grail. I could not believe that murder scene looks exactly like it did 63 years ago. It has not changed a bit. And so, if you read the book, you'll find some crime scene photos in there that I got from the state police, and you'll find the pictures of that gate with the stone pillars is where this happened at. And it looks identical to how it looked back then. It's just incredible to me.
Yeah. Just the place caught in time.
Yeah, it really was.
Yep. And so, yeah. Okay. So you've got, you're up there at the actual scene and getting a lay of Mackinac. And then, so the rest of your footnotes are, you know, the cases, the case stuff, the newspapers. I mean, it was a ton. How if you could put a gauge an hour to how much time you spent researching this book, how much do you think it would be?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. And I'm going to be perfectly frank with you. I honestly can't tell you. I know I spent 2 days on the island, just walking back and forth, looking at the downtown area, visiting the crime scene a couple different times, taking some measurements. And then I did go to the Mackinac Island Library, and they were gracious enough to actually dig out some old, the paper up there is called the Mackinac Island Town Crier. They dug out some old papers from the late 50s and early 60s. They didn't have a lot of information, but they were very, very gracious to me and helpful. And then down here, a lot of my time was spent on categorizing the police files that I got from the state police. I literally created a 10-page spreadsheet indicating different sections of the police report that were of note to me, that offered clues to me. I guess you could call me an amateur cold case investigator, because that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to solve this murder. And so I would find something in the police report and think, I think they overlooked this. I think they forgot about this. And I'd make a note of it. So I had this 10-page spreadsheet that I used to reference back to the police report. And then a lot of my time was spent on newspapers.com, which is a great resource. And then finding some of the old, there was, I think, two other books that had a short, very short chapters about the murder. They were a compilation of different crimes and mysterious things around Michigan. And they both had very short chapters about the Lacey murder that really offered nothing to me. The one thing that I did spend a lot of time on was trying to find an old, I can't think of the name of the magazine now. It escapes me, but...
Was it True Crime? Was it the True Crime magazine?
It was like a True Crime magazine, yeah. And in 1962, 2 years after the murder, they did an article about the murder in hopes that it would generate some clues. And it actually did get some response. And I talk about that very briefly. But interestingly enough, and you'll appreciate this, John, because you've probably heard of the book Street Survival. And those were written by a guy named Remsburg, if that's his last name. Well, he's the guy that wrote the article in 1962.
No way.
Lacey murder in that police magazine, Charles Remsburg.
Yeah.
And I tried to find that original magazine or a copy of it, and I couldn't. I found a collector site that had a price on it, and it had a picture of the cover and the first page. And so I got some very brief notes from that, but I never got the full article.
Yeah, those old Caliber Press books. I remember having those. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Street Survival and all those things.
Charles Remsburg. Wow.
Yeah, that's funny. And I'll tell you, last time we talked, you put me on to newspapers.com, and I've never seen such a rabbit hole as that. Like, you can get lost for hours on that thing. Just it's like when you go to the library and dig out the microfiche. Like, you can get lost and like in a time warp going through those things.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's a great resource. So I would say I spent a significant amount of time on research in this book. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the footnotes and the bibliography. It's like, if there's like three pages that go by that doesn't have a footnote attached to it, I was like, man. But another comment I made in the margins as I'm reading, capturing those newspaper clippings were really good at setting the tone, like getting a feel for how the islanders or the people on the island. Of course, we've got the tourists and then we've got the natives, so to speak. But the idea of, you know, the the natives, the islanders, the full-time people there are, you know, kind of locking their doors at night, suddenly looking over their shoulder, you know, question, wondering, looking side-eyed at the shady neighbor. And then the tourists on the other side are just, you know, drinking, going out to dinner and having a blast and no idea what's going on. You know, it seemed like there's a dichotomy, dichotomy there. I screwed up too many words tonight. I'm still kind of pissed. I'm still kind of pissed at myself for the Mackinac Island thing, but I'm not going to edit that out either. I'm going to let it stand. Okay. But yeah, that tone was set with those newspaper articles. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And I try, if you notice that the newspaper articles, really, they kind of follow from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. And there comes a point in the middle of the book where I get into the possibility that the killer was a serial killer, an early serial killer, one mm-hmm. that maybe this was his first murder. And all of a sudden you don't see newspaper articles anymore, because it's literally you're talking about mid 60s, 70s now. And so that's when I start footnoting the books that I used in my research, which is fascinating. And I understand why people are fascinated with serial killers. They want to know what makes them tick. They really do. And I don't think, well, they obviously didn't have that technology, or that, it's not really a technology, it's an art. That wasn't developed back in the 60s. Until the mid 70s. And we actually, in this particular book, we have two profiles, one from the FBI and one from the state police. And I yeah. think the one from the state police was actually much more detailed than the one from the FBI. But they're working on with a police report that's 60 years old, or you know, 55 yeah. years old at that time, whatever. So it's something new. And it never catches the killer. It's just, I point out in the book, it's a tool in their investigation.
Yep. And
just
and
like,
I mean,
positivist.
Yeah. And there's a lot of good, I mean, that VICAP study, very, very worthwhile. I mean, you know, and the whole BAU profiling thing takes a hit every now and then, but they're going off statistics and they're comparing knowns to unknowns. And but it's fascinating especially when you look at all the different suspects they talk to and all the different leads they track down. The place you put those profiles in the book, as you're reading it, you're thinking back of all those other suspects that they ended up interrogating and felt really good about, and then they just slipped out of their fingers, right? It was a great time to review and then move forward after that. I found that very beneficial after all the other names had popped up over and over again.
And I think you made a really great point there when you mentioned, yeah, some of it slipped through their fingers. I think there were some viable suspects, one in particular. You know, I said I think that there's two people they should look at. One of them is Weingart, and the other one is mentioned in the book. Mm-hmm. I think that second one slipped through their fingers. I really do. And I think that he warrants some further investigation. He is not alive anymore. But there's one key piece of evidence that's mentioned. And I think that they should have taken it a step further.
Yep.
Yeah, there was. If the evidence is located down the road, they still could.
Yep. It seemed a little stunted. And if I'm thinking the right guy, but yeah, no, I love the way you laid it out, and especially the way you ended it, because it's not like you're asking for the world. You're just asking for a little bit more legwork on top of all the tenacity that those guys in the 60s showed to just track down every scrap of potential that case had, you know? So,
yep. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just my meager opinion, but I really enjoyed it. And with that being said, I try not to keep people past an hour, but going back, you know, with your background and your history, and looking at the what catches me is just the professionalism of these guys working within their time with the technology they had, and several of them continue to pop up. The police officers continue to pop up over the years when a lead comes up, you know, they're now commander of a post instead of a street detective, but they're still involved. And you can feel the frustration that they have and that they have a case that slipped by them. So I was wondering, if you don't have to answer if it hits a little too close, but do you have any cases that from your 30 years on the job where, you know, that just seem to get away and that you still think about every now and then?
And some of them aren't my cases. They're cases that were in the mid-Michigan area here. I can think of one specific missing person. Her case is still unsolved. A lot of people have approached me and said, you should write a book about her case. I'm just not prepared to do that right now. I have another case that actually is the subject of my fifth book. And I won't go into a lot of detail, but it does involve another serial killer who's in prison. And I truly believe that there may be some unsolved cases that he was involved in, and not necessarily here in Michigan. And so in addition to doing my research for the stuff that I know about to put in the book, now I'm trying to dig into some stuff that I don't know about that may not even exist. So it's like a rabbit hole. You know, you're like, should I go down here? Should I look at this? I think I should. Yep. I really do. Yeah. But I've got a lot of great, I'm just going to say I have some fantastic resources for that particular book. And so I hope I answered that question correctly. In my career, a lot of my stuff was solved. You know, I don't worry about B&Es that didn't get solved, you know, 20 years ago. I was involved kind of in a tertiary way as an investigator in some homicides where I would do the crime scene diagrams and things like that. But those were always after the fact where the guy had been caught and they needed something prepared as a court exhibit. So most of those were all solved. There is a couple unsolved murders here in Eaton County, which is where I served for 25 years, that I think about every now and again, and wonder if they'll ever get solved. But they don't haunt me by any means.
Yeah. It's I just wondered because you know you're a long career. You know, just wondered if there was one that got away. I told you I wouldn't keep you too long. So,
well, listen, you keep me as long as you need to, because I screwed up the whole technical aspect of this to start with, but we started 20 minutes late anyway.
Oh, that's all right. I got two little fellas. I gotta get ready for school in the morning anyway. I hope you want to talk about the fifth one when that thing's ready to come out too, because I thoroughly enjoyed Grim Paradise.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to seeing it on the shelves coming August 22nd. And your socials, where can people find you?
They can find me on Facebook, Rod Sadler Author. There's actually two Rod Sadler authors. I haven't figured out how to get rid of the other one. It was a site I started years ago, but it's still out there. The one they want to look for is the one with the black and white photo. That's the one that I do all of my publicity on. I'm also on Instagram, Rod Sadler Author. I'm on X now, not Twitter, X. I don't do a lot of stuff on X, but I am on there. And I'm also do a little bit of work on TikTok publicize my books. So, yeah, that's where they can find me on social media.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining me, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you having me, and I'll be sure and let you know when the next one comes out.
All right. Thanks a lot. And I still can't believe I messed up Mackinac Island, but I'm going to keep it. So everybody enjoy that at my expense, and have a good night, everybody.